Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Hello and welcome to Week to Week, the news commentary program from the Commonwealth Club of California. I am John Zipperer, Vice President of Media and Editorial at the Commonwealth Club, and I have the pleasure of being your host today. Were any of you at the club this week for our new members reception? I talked to a number of folks, and I was so pleased to get into some discussions where people really understood what we're trying to do here. And a number of folks said to me specifically, boy, they love to hear talk about politics and current events where it's not kind of the shouting matches on cable TV or where the other person's, you know, your enemy if you disagree with them. And I was just pleased to have people say that to me, that that's what they were looking for, because that's certainly what we're trying to do here. So certainly we're all glad you're here, and I think you're going to enjoy it. And along those lines, I should offer a reminder that all of us today here, we're expressing, I can barely express, but we're expressing our opinions. And they're only our opinions. They certainly aren't those of the Commonwealth Club, our members, our donors, our FedEx delivery people, or anyone else. So let's meet our first two panelists for today. To my immediate right is Deborah J. Saunders, a syndicated columnist based at the San Francisco Chronicle, where she also writes the sfgate.com blog called Token Conservative. In addition to her appearances here on Week to Week, she also is a frequent guest on national radio and television programs, and you can follow her on Twitter at Deborah J. Saunders. And on the end is Dr. Larry Gersten, a professor of political science at San Jose State University. He's also a political analyst at NBC 11. And as I noted earlier, his new book is out. It's his 11th book, and we are going to be giving away a copy during our news quiz at the end of today's program.
Barry White.
And a little later in this program, we're going to be joined on stage by Carla Marinucci, San Francisco Chronicle political writer and colleague of Deborah's. So let's get into our discussion of current events. I almost want to rub my hands. Let's start, if you will, with student loans. This is a topic where both we see in the political sphere, both sides are coming out with plans of one sort or another. Deborah, do you want to start and tell us what's being proposed and why is this issue a campaign issue even?
It's a campaign issue because it's an election year and both candidates are vying for the youth vote. And when in 2007, when Congress decided to lower interest rates for Stafford student loans from 6.8% to 3.4%, they put a sunset on it for July 1. Gee, do you think that they knew it was going to be an election year?
So cynical.
I don't know. So here we are at this point where you have Democrats and Republicans fighting over it. Now, Barack Obama went to three college campuses this weekend and basically said the Republicans don't want to cut a deal on this, and they're fighting on it. The truth is, Democrats have been pushing to get this this lowered, and they have their way of doing it, which is either by taxing sub-S corporations or oil companies. That's how they want to pay for it. It's about $6 billion. Republicans, some of them have wondered whether it's a great idea. It's a minority of them have wondered if it's a great idea to keep subsidizing higher education, because we've seen tuition just go up just so tremendously in the last few decades as subsidies have risen. But they're all going to go along with it. Mitt Romney says he wants to keep it lower as well. So the Republicans are saying, we want to do it. We just want to cut spending. And now they're going to spend basically the next 6 weeks saying, we want to do it, the other guys don't. And they're going to cut a deal in the end. And that's, and everyone, you know, and we'll all be more cynical when it's over, because it wouldn't have been nice if they can find $6 billion they can agree on happily in a $3.6 trillion budget, don't you think?
They're going to agree on something eventually after the election, I assume.
No. They'll do it because July 1 is the deadline.
They have to.
So they have to, and they'll do it. But they're going to try to milk it and point to the other guys are bad. And so that's what will happen.
Larry? Yeah, that's a good summary. I think there are a couple of things that hit me. One is, of course, in politics, symbolism is so much more important so often than any one thing. And to me, this is a lot more than student loans. It's about where you're going to get the money. It's about are we going to subsidies are interesting. You know, what's a subsidy to someone is a necessity to somebody else. And they point fingers at each other on subsidies. You know, which is one interesting story. Someone once said, "Get rid of all the subsidies," and I think both sides would probably blanch at that. But the other thing that I find kind of interesting about this is that it's the first time where I see Romney making that pivot. He's pivoting back to the center. He had to go way out there to the right to get the nomination. I am convinced to this day he said things that he looked in the mirror and said, "I said that?" No. And so now this is the first. There'll be other issues. And by the way, it's not unusual. Of course, we saw Obama do the same thing in 2008. Romney has a much longer road to travel, but this is the first time that he, right away, he went on that, well before the Republican leadership in the House said anything. I'm there. Of course we're not going to trivialize this. So I find that kind of interesting.
Sort of rapid response.
Huh? Yep. And it will be other. This is the first one. Yeah.
Yeah. What does that say, do you think, about the role that the youth vote is going to play in this race?
Well, we're pretty confident that young voters, look, last time young voters came out for Obama 2-1. And they came out in decent numbers. They weren't nearly as impressive as most people thought. People got caught up with the 2-1.
Yeah.
You know, well, for three people, 2-1 doesn't mean a lot. They'll come out for Obama again this year, but the question is, as with so many cohorts, will they be motivated? You know, will they feel like they've gotten their money's worth the last 4 years? And if they do, then that will be critical in a couple of states to him, like North Carolina being one of them. Mm-hmm. If they don't, he'll have to pick up the vote someplace else or risk losing it.
Well, we'll be getting into the general election a little bit more, obviously, when we bring Carla up. But just along those lines, and I've lost my train of thought. So.
Can I jump in for a sec?
Perfect.
Because I do think that Mitt Romney is going to compete for the youth vote with Barack Obama. Barack Obama will get more, you know, he'll get more than 50% of it. But if I think a number of students are looking ahead at the economy and they're not sure they're going to get jobs when they graduate. Or they've just graduated, they're under 25, and they have concerns. So I think you're absolutely right, Larry. What Obama fears is depressed turnout. He's afraid that kids are just going to stay home. But also, I think if Mitt Romney can do 10% better than John McCain, that's a big coup, too. And I do think that that is something that is that's very doable for Mitt Romney.
I would add, also, it's almost a cliche that people expect that the youth vote will go for the Democrats. But, you know, as a number of people have mentioned, Ronald Reagan won the youth vote, and he won a whole generation of people.
Right. And Deborah, you made this point weeks ago, that the uncanny association between youth who liked Obama in 2008 and so many of them who seem enthralled with
Ron Paul.
You know, so, I mean, I think of all the groups out there, this is the one we can least control, so to speak. You know, we don't know where they're going to go because they're young. And young people do, they go off in all kinds of directions.
Not like folks our age.
No, we're just plodding along.
Those crazy kids. Well, for our next topic, let's actually revisit a topic that we talked about at our last event here, our last week-to-week program, and that is the Ross Mercurimi saga. For anyone who doesn't know the tale, Mercurimi is a former San Francisco city supervisor. He's been suspended from his position as sheriff due to a physical altercation with his wife, which occurred before he took office, but after he won the election for that office. Now, last time we went quite deep into the issues of domestic violence and the privacy issues involved and what roles those would play. This time, I guess I'd like to first bring us up to date. What is the process right now? What are we seeing between the mayor and is this going through the court system or is it an administrative issue?
This is going to go on forever.
Yeah,
John,
really?
Can I poll the audience here on this?
Sure.
How many people here think Ross Mercurimi that the supervisors should vote to get rid of him? Okay. And how many think that the supervisor should keep him, should vote that he stays? Okay. Because I'm
3-1.
Always fascinated to see how people react to this story. You know, I get emails from people, you can't quite tell.
Yeah.
Now, I'm somebody who feels that that the mayor should not have filed official misconduct charges because He wasn't sheriff when it happened. This had nothing to do with his being in office. And also, I believe that the fact that he bruised his wife's arm is not something that you destroy somebody's life over. Not a good thing. I'm not defending it, but I'll say that. So where are we, was your question, yeah. John. This thing is going to go on forever. Monday, I went to the San Francisco City Ethics Commission. By the way, the chairman's name is Ben Hur. Just, okay. So it's Benedict Hur, and his parents did know what they were doing when they named him. So anyway, and there you had the deputy city attorney, Peter J. Keith, and you had Shep Kopp and David Wagoner, the two attorneys, and Ross Mercurimi was sitting there, and they were discussing what's going to happen with the ethics committee. Now, this fight happened New Year's Eve, and so this has been going on for a few months. So when you'd think that things are going to work quickly, oh, no. There's a big fight over what the burden of proof will be. They're going to have a mini trial, what the standards are. So the rules for this are going to be issued on May 29. And then they're going to have the mini trial, and they have to have people and then the Ethics Commission makes a recommendation, and then the supervisors vote. So we've got months of this to go. And it'll be really fascinating to see how it plays out.
You mentioned you didn't think the cause was there for legal cause for him to be suspended from his position. Was this this struck me as being kind of an unexpected move by Mayor Lee, who has a reputation for being behind the scenes, calm, not dramatic. And this was a very strong move to make, whether you agree with it or disagree with it. Mm-hmm. Is this a change by him, or is this just a side of him we publicly didn't know about?
I don't know. To me, San Francisco, this is political correctness run amok, and Ed Lee being involved in that doesn't surprise me for a minute.
Oh.
But wise man.
You know, he had to put the issue someplace. You know, I think he felt that he couldn't make it go away. He didn't want to own it. I'm talking about Mayor Lee.
Yeah.
Actually, from his point of view, it was pretty smart to put it in the hands of the Ethics Commission, some other body, okay, away from him. I think that was a smart political move, but Deborah's right, and the only exception I take is I don't think this is going to go on for months. I think it's going to go on for years. the reason why is because this is, in a sense, a beta site. It's brand new, fresh. This kind of thing hasn't been done. It will be tested at every step along the way. What will be allowed? What will not be allowed? Under what conditions will something be allowed? I mean, there'll be literally court cases, you know, at every step of the way to determine, you know, the functionality of the Ethics Commission. And for that reason, this thing is going to go on for a long time. And that's kind of unfortunate for all the parties.
And let me say, I agree with you, Larry, that it was a savvy political move on Ed Lee's part, because he basically, you know, passed the hot potato to someone else to deal with.
Yeah.
But what bothers me about this is I've read through the official misconduct claim, and it's just not substantiated. They're still on a fishing expedition. So, they're saying that we know he bruised his wife's arm. That's not in question. They're also saying that he tried to dissuade witnesses, but they're on a fishing expedition to prove that. They don't have that. And so I think it's going to take Larry's right a long time.
I would think also that even if the official process is over in months rather than years, the ramifications of it politically, because, I mean, this is doing something interesting to the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco, is the moderate liberal versus the liberal split, and this is wrenching some of that around. I would expect to see.
Right. By the way, I have a column in Sunday's San Francisco Chronicle on this.
Oh, are you giving us a heads up?
But you're right. I mean, this is the progressive side of the politics versus the, you know, what in San Francisco passes for moderates. So.
Well, am I wrong to kind of look at this and put it in the same basket as another case we've seen around here, which is the Nadia Lockyer effort? And she, of course, left on her own, right? Or was she forced to resign? She resigned her position as an Alameda County supervisor over some personal matters.
She just had no way out. I mean,
really?
She was, politically speaking, at the end of her rope. Look, Mercurimi, Lockyer, Newsom, there's a long list of people who find themselves in hot water. The real question is not that you get into hot water. How do you manage it once you get in?
Yeah.
Crisis management 101. Gavin Newsom dealt with it right away.
Very well.
Right away. You know, let's not let a head of steam go here. I did it. It was a mistake. I was shame on me. I'm going into rehab.
Everything you've heard is all true. That was the first thing he said at the press conference.
Right. And so, you know, how long can you spin that story? It's done. It's over. Lockyer is the next case in the sense that she thought about this for a while, saw the story spinning. It now implicates her husband, who has planned. I don't know if he will now to run for controller. I think it is next time around.
Hasn't he been everything else?
That's about it. Yeah, in 2014, term limits stick us again. But let's not get there now. At any rate, so you know, there's a lot of people who are being caught up into this thing. Mm-hmm. She finally realizes, I got to get out of this. You know, does she have a future? Well, she's 41 years old. I suppose she might. You got to give some time out there. Now you get to Mukherjee, and he won't let the story die.
Yeah.
You know, and just from the standpoint of a crisis management point of view, it's all wrong. You know, contrition wins friends. You know, contrition wins forgiveness. And, you know, there's never been that kind of closure. So whether he finds himself legally stuck, he certainly is politically stuck.
You know, I was writing down as you were talking some of the... We have so many scandals right now. And so
that's what keeps us busy.
I know. It makes my job easier. So we've got the GSA story that everybody's been watching about. It's District 9. This is ground zero for it. Nadia Lockyer and, as Larry points out, Bill Lockyer, who's everybody's wondering... we know he put a lot of money in her campaign.
A million
they
and
are
a half
supervisors.
Dollars.
That's right. And so didn't... Why did he do that if he knew that she maybe wasn't in a position to really serve well? Mary Hayashi, assemblywoman who was caught shoplifting at Neiman Marcus. Ross Mukherjee, who did plead guilty to a misdemeanor count and said he takes responsibility.
Sort of.
Well, he just doesn't think he should lose his job. And Pete Stark, the congressman from Fremont, who accused... He basically accused his opponent in the primary of being on the take, and then with no proof whatsoever, and he finally had to back off on that. So we've got, it's ugly, folks. It's ugly out there.
He also accused his opponent of having a terrible voting record, and it turns out he's voted in every election.
Yeah. No.
How can it get any better than that?
That's right.
Maybe I could vote twice like Chicago. I don't know. but you know, yeah, that's an interesting thing to watch, you know, the Stark race. I think there's a lot of trouble.
Do you think
there.
It's serious for him because of this?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think he, by far, is the most vulnerable of all the congressional incumbents.
Really?
Yeah, I really do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, these issues where they're the ones that involve someone's private life, that's messy. And let's face it, lots of people's lives are messy privately. It always kind of raises the question of where... When does it become of our interest? When does it affect the job? What sort of thing? Do you have any thoughts on, let's just stick to the Lockyer and Mukherjee events. I mean, even if, for example, there weren't enough, it didn't rise to the level of job removal for Mukherjee, should that be any of our business whatsoever that it happened? Is it a private matter?
Well, why is it... If a man bruises his wife's arm, why would somebody like me be defending him? Because if he'd hurt her, I would be very upset. She says he didn't hurt her. She never filed charges. I mean, this is just a messy case, and I just don't think it leveled to rose to the level of a prosecution. But you don't want to have a sheriff, a guy who has a gun and who's head of law enforcement, hurting somebody in his family. So obviously, if this were a prosecutable domestic violence case, if he'd broke her arm, if he'd anything like that, I mean, if that would be a completely different story. I'm sorry, folks. People have ugly fights when they're married, and they do stupid things. And The older I get and the longer I'm in this business, the less I feel like jumping into people for their personal behavior. And it's really easy to look at someone and say, you know, he has to go. But they had a stupid fight and he grabbed her arm. And if we want to get rid of somebody for that, well, Gavin Newsom, who when he was mayor admitted to having an affair with a staffer, that was not exactly just personal. She worked for City Hall as an appointment secretary. So, and I felt at the time that he was a good mayor. He came clean about things. Let him stay. So that's my standard. But.
I'm more gray on this deal.
Okay.
I always think of like that MasterCard symbol, those two overlapping circles. There's something in the middle, right?
Oh, what are they called?
I don't know. Something fancy. Oh. If it's two syllables or more,
with a
I don't
w.
know it. A what?
But this is it. The yeah. Venn diagram.
Oh,
right?
Yes. Overlap.
You guys are good. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean,
Commonwealth Club audiences. They'll get
there's a private life. There's a public life. And when you're in politics, or for that matter, when you're a high-ranking person in a corporation, mm-hmm. The Best Buy CEO, Mark Hurd at HP, same thing. You're accountable. In politics, you're accountable to those who put you in. And when you're a CEO or something like that, you're accountable to your stockholders and your employees. The level of expected behavior changes, and the scrutiny of that behavior grows. So it may not be that we should. I'm not suggesting that we should necessarily, but we do. We do. And in the process, when we see these people behaving in ways that may not even be illegal, but are certainly unethical, it then leads us to say, what about their judgment in other matters? If they've done this, how do I know they're not going to do something else in an area that will affect me? Mm. And that's where it's gray for me. You know, I can't tell you we shouldn't be there at all, because I think there are times we learn something about a person's character. We learn about their character. And that's when you begin to say, I didn't know about all this. I don't know how I feel about this person now. That's where it gets difficult.
And voters, I mean, there is a recall process if voters feel so moved. I feel it's a good idea to be very careful before a group tries to overturn an election.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would suggest to you that if he goes at all, that will be the way it happens. That will be the way it happens, regardless of how appropriate you think it might be, because that's one thing that nobody can control. You know,
right.
you get voters with a mat on, they'll get those signatures right away.
Well, let's move on to a happier topic, and that is that at the end of this month, we are going to be celebrating 75 years of the Golden Gate Bridge since its opening in 1937. The bridge was very controversial when it was being planned and built. Kevin Starr, the California historian, has even included in his book that the Commonwealth Club came out against the bridge. We might reconsider that at some point, but for now... And eventually the bridge, the financing was only made possible when some big bankers basically stepped in and offered to provide the critical missing amounts. Today, of course, it's one of the indispensable, seemingly, symbols of California, of the Bay Area, of San Francisco. And I even put it in a category of one of those symbols that's a local symbol, a local monument that the whole nation kind of includes. You know, the Statue of Liberty, yes, by New York and New Jersey, but we all kind of consider that to be part of ours. Can I just ask, how many of you have actually walked across the bridge? Pretty much I've done it. We have to get Larry to do it, maybe.
Yeah, that's right.
Jeez.
Right afterward. We're
I'm
all going to go over the bridge.
Yeah. Well, let me put a negative spin then on a positive thing, which is that we don't seem to be building these things anymore. Whenever we hear about these grand new edifices, the new infrastructure, the new bridges, the new buildings, they're in China. Maybe Dubai. Does that and you know, it'd be tempting to say, well, we're in a very bad economic time, but 75 years ago we were in the Great Depression. So any thoughts, Larry?
Listen, I actually touched on some of this stuff in my book. I find it very upsetting, and more than upsetting, I find it an indicator of where we are as a society. You know, our reluctance to invest in infrastructure. You know, when Pat Brown was governor, those were really nice times in many ways. That's when we came up with the comprehensive higher education plan. Mm-hmm. That's when we came up with California's interstate highway system. It's phenomenal. And Pat Brown, I believe it was in 1959, went to the voters and asked the voters to pass a $1.7 billion program to build the California water system. $1.7 billion. Now, I realize $1.7 billion right now seems like petty change to a lot of people, but the fact of the matter is that was the budget for that year. That was the budget. That was the state budget. Okay? So he asked them basically to do that. Now fast forward to the high-speed rail system. Mm-hmm. The price for the high-speed rail system, well, at least this morning, is $68 billion. Okay? The state budget is around $90, $95 billion. You see where I'm going? We're in a tizzy over this thing, over the high-speed rail. Okay? But the voters moved right ahead and committed to this. And I think it says a lot about the times. I think it says a lot about the investment of our individuals then and our investment now. And I do believe that Californians today are looking one foot out the door rather than both feet in.
Any thoughts?
I look at the Bay Bridge. So 1989, Loma Prieta, part of it comes down. We still haven't finished. It's over 20 years later.
That's right.
And we still haven't finished the retrofit. Why? Because we can't agree on anything in the Bay Area. And people in the Bay Area, they didn't care about it. I mean, to me, this has just been astonishing. I drive over the Bay Bridge frequently. I live in the East Bay. And do you know what it's built on, the eastern span? It's on pine trees, right? So it's not safe. And you would think that people would be demanding that the government fix it right away. In fact, in L.A., when they had, Northridge?
Yep.
And that part of the freeway fell down, Pete Wilson made sure that it was rebuilt in 6 months' time, that just part of the freeway. But here, everybody dithered. People didn't care. There's this self-loathing car thing. And so, and there were measures on the ballot to put a trolley on the new span, which was ridiculous because then we know how bad it is to drive on it now, how much gridlock there is. So you want to take one third of the space. Jerry Brown delayed it, and other East Bay mayors because they wanted to have a big design. They didn't, if we had a big earthquake and something happened, it would be a disaster, and it still isn't done yet. It's finally going to be done. What, 2014 or 13?
It'll be 25 years.
And that's for a retrofit for a bridge that we know is not safe in an earthquake. So, what does that tell you? In LA, they wanted it fixed and it got fixed, but that was not the emphasis up here.
Well, okay, enough of that. Let's get back to scandal. All of the list you have there of local scandals, I think, kind of pales in comparison to kind of. Might be me being too opinionated, but the John Edwards, scandal machine. He's in court right now. Tell us what's going on and what we can expect to receive out of that. Do you play Larry?
Well, the problem with the Edwards case, we got into this in the boardroom before we even came out tonight. We were already swinging. The problem with the Edwards case is not so much what was done, but whether the movement of money for his, can we call her a girlfriend? What was she?
Mistress?
The person carrying his child, best I can do.
I would want to say baby mama.
Mistake?
Mistake, that was her name, Mistake, right. Anyway, the problem was that, I think it was over $1 million was moved over.
$925,000.
And so the question is, was it done legally or illegally? And, of course, he's charged with doing it illegally. And we were saying earlier, I was saying, that there are two things to look at here. One is the ethics of the whole thing. All right, I don't know if we all do. I think a number of us feel quite a bit of contempt and disappointment. But the other thing is legality. And sometimes we rush to convict somebody because we're angry with what he did or she did. And that doesn't mean that person should be convicted. I mean, there are a lot of people who do dumb, unethical things out there. Maybe that gets back to the Mercurimi thing. Same thing. If people do dumb things, does that mean they're guilty of a crime? And quite frankly, I'm not convinced yet that as offensive as the act was, I'm not convinced that he's guilty of a crime. Now,
He's guilty. Okay.
Next case.
I'm sorry. It's, you know, we have a $2,300. It was in 2008. $2,300 contribution limit per election. Super PACs. People get around that now. But that's the law. That's the law that John Edwards supported. He was a big McCain-Feingold guy, and he knew that money was being funneled to support her, and it was to help his campaign. And that's all there was to it. But I want to say one other thing. The next time you feel when you meet a Republican and you say, hey, I want to give you a hard time about Sarah Palin, just remember that you guys, he was the Democrats' running mate in 2004, and he could have been president. And in 2008, he could have been president, and he's seeing this woman. It would have completely destroyed the Democratic Party. It didn't stop him. And then when he couldn't become president because it came out, he thought Barack Obama might make, because the campaign didn't take off, he thought Obama might make him his running mate. And then he thought maybe he'll be attorney general. Now think about this, because if you believe in all these campaign finance laws, and you're going to be the guy who actually enforces them, I think you sort of understand when your campaign chairman, your finance chairman, is going around the $2,300 limit. But that's just me.
Don't hold back, Deborah. I will say meekly that I need to see more than he knew. I need to see him signing off on something. I need to see, okay, J-E, whatever his initials would be. I need to see evidence. I know, I'm old-fashioned.
Excuse me, but they have been taught. He knew where she was, what she was doing. He knew that someone was supporting her. He told Andrew Young, I don't want to be told things because I don't want to know them. That means he knows them. Right? So I'm sorry. And if you believe in campaign finance laws, you should want to see if he can get away with it just because you know there's a girlfriend involved, and then there's no meaning in having these laws at all, and there's no point in enforcing them. But that's just my humble opinion.
Okay. Well, I think we'll have that topic to talk about for some time. Just a quick reminder, those of you listening to us online or on the radio, this is the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. This is our week-to-week news discussion featuring this week Dr. Larry Gersten, Deborah J. Saunders, and Carla Marinucci. And in fact, let's bring up Carla to our stage. Here, I've warmed up a chair for you. I'll take
you
in.
Okay. Thank you.
Carla Marinucci is a senior political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, where she has covered national and state politics since 1996. She's reported on and traveled with, which must have been a lot of fun, presidential campaigns around the country, as well as gubernatorial and congressional races. And she's one of the state's top political bloggers. Definitely check her out. She's on the SF Chronicle's Spin Cycle Politics blog at sfgate.com. And she's on Twitter at @cmarinucci. So we have two Chronicle people here. We're going to team up on Larry and get him on Twitter.
That's right.
Obviously, we're here because, there are primaries still grinding on in insignificant states like California. But this race is over as far as the primaries. Am I right?
We were on a press call this week with Jim Messina and David Axelrod from the Obama campaign. And the first statement Messina made was, welcome to the general election campaign. Mm. I mean, look, we're from California here. This is the ATM of the presidential race. We've seen these guys come in a million times. You know, Obama, you should get him a heliport. He's here so often. So, I mean, this has been going on for a long time. Now we sort of pivot and get to the themes we're starting to see, even this week. What some of the themes where we see Mr. Cool versus Mr. Corporate. We see Karl Rove just put out a new ad today talking about Obama being just too cool for school. Yeah. And we're seeing Romney. I have to say, he came back this week with a sort of back at you campaign, following Obama around, hitting him on the same issues. I think this sort of tells us this is going to go down to the wire. And right now we're showing these polls being very even. And I think there's, when you're talking about national polls, not a lot of sort of importance, I think. It's all about the swing states and it's all about likely voters. But the fact is, if Obama is even with Romney at this point, they got to be sweating it, and they got to be—they know that this is going to go down to the wire.
They're also collecting. We read this morning, I think it was the New York Times, are collecting much less money from high-end donors than the Obama campaign expected, which has put a lot of pressure on them to go broad. They've always been broad, but you know, you can only count on so much at the bottom end.
That's right. These super PACs, as we all know, have changed the face of this election. They're going to change it here in California, too. And you were talking about John Edwards. I mean, and we were talking about this. Ironically, had super PACs existed, he would never have a problem because these guys would just put money. And that's what the situation is.
If there's interaction between the campaign and the super PACs, that's illegal.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
So
but the fact is that these are unlimited, you know, donors, and they've changed the face of what's going on. And we're seeing this happen in California, too. So the Obama campaign has one advantage in terms of the ground game. They've got hundreds of offices opened around the country, including in California. They have the email list. They are working it. And when we talk about critical voter groups, youth, women, Hispanics, they are way ahead of the Republicans right now. But the fact is, Romney's campaign has shown the ability to get up to speed really fast. This week, I thought, he hit Obama on the central theme of this election, which is fairness. Obama's talking about the fairness of increasing taxes on the wealthiest to pay for things, education and so forth. Romney came back at him with, you know, is it fair to give your buddies business contracts in places like Salinda? Is it fair to pass debt on to the next generation? He used that term 16 times in his speech this week, big speech this week. That's an example of the kind of sort of arguments you're going to be seeing going forward.
We've seen in some past elections where the candidate that kind of has an advantage will often, if it's a big, strong advantage, and they've got good communications, that they will use that advantage to try to define the other candidate before that candidate can, you know, introduce themselves really to the voters. So in this Etch-a-Sketch moment, is Romney kind of effectively getting out of the Obama administration or the Obama campaign from defining him as they had hoped to, as either the flip-flopper or the, you know, Mr. Hard Right?
That is Romney's challenge to me, especially when you talk about, for instance, Hispanic outreach. You know, one of the CNN analysts already said, look, we're seeing the birth of Hispander, which is pandering, using merciless, you know, use of mariachi bands and, you know, killing the Spanish language and bringing out tacos and Viva signs everywhere you go. That's a Hispander. And the Romney campaign is already going there. He's going to have a real problem when it comes to Hispanics. He's got Pete Wilson as an endorser, you know. I can tell you that I went to Mexico with Governor Schwarzenegger, went outside in the street. Does the name Pete Wilson mean anything to you? And immediately I heard words that I cannot say on the radio. People, you know, from Mexico to New York to the critical voting states, and we're talking about Florida, Nevada, swing states, the Arizona law, calling it a model, the DREAM Act, saying you would veto it, these are things that Romney is already trying to explain, and that's going to be a challenge for him.
Well, Larry. Yes, but I think just as we talked about Romney pivoting on the student loan issue, I think the second area that he's begun to pivot on is the immigration issue. Marco Rubio's proposal is out there. And sure, it's not nearly enough for people in the DREAM Act, but it certainly is a step or two away from the resistance Republicans have shown to date. And Romney said, I'm going to look at this. I'm going to give some thought. So to me, that suggests his first entree into, you know, working his way into the good graces of the Hispanic or the Latino voting community. And remember, as we've all said, we don't expect him to get a majority, you know, but can he get more than 32%? Can he get 38%?
That's right.
If he can get 38% instead of 32%, and it's not national.
I was just going to ask. It matters which
states.
No,
we're talking New Mexico, okay? You turn New Mexico. We're talking Colorado. You turn Colorado. You
know, Nevada, Arizona.
Arizona, I think, will be theirs anyway. But I mean, you know, we're only talking about 7, 8, 9 states altogether.
The other thing is that Barack Obama has some problems with the Latino community. He promised his first year that he would pass immigration reform. Yeah. Didn't even try.
Right.
Didn't even try. Now he's promising it again for the first year of his second term. So, and I think, as you know, probably know, deportations hit a record amount in his early years as president. He really did enforce immigration laws. Then he turned around and did this complete 360, and they have. I have brain freeze for a second. The immigration program where they're taking people who have criminal backgrounds and they're the people
right.
they're trying to deport.
Right.
And he told Homeland Security to start and ICE to start looking at everything all over again before they start deporting people. So he's done a complete 180. Now, I think the Republicans have an argument here that the Latino community, if they thought they were going to get all these things from them, they've been used. And you've been used once. You can be used twice. So I think that, again, I don't expect Mitt Romney to win the Latino vote. But I think that, again, one of the views in politics, sometimes one of your goals is to depress turnout. And I think that there are a lot of doubts that can be, seeds of doubt that can be sown in the minds of Latino voters.
Mm-hmm. Do you think social issues will help him, will help Romney with Latino voters? I mean, tends to be a bit more conservative voting bloc on certain issues.
That seems to be one of the lines of attack. That, I'm not sure that is going to be. I think it comes down to economics, and for many Latino voters, it's also a line in the sand is a path to citizenship. And as we know in the Republican debates, there was some very strong language used on that, and I think it's going to be, as Larry said, a challenge for them to convince Latino voters that they have some kind of
etch-a-sketch. Most people not paying attention though to the primaries. Obviously, we do, but
and I think those.
Think
I think the
communities
the attacks that were used in the primaries and some of the statements that Romney has made with regard to self deportation and so forth. Yeah. Those are going to be used in ads.
We should also add. I mean, the Latino community is not monolithic.
Right.
There are people who have different viewpoints
and
who would agree with a number of Mitt Romney's positions. So, again, you're always fighting over that wavy middle that goes back and forth.
You'll see Romney do better with the Puerto Rican community for a number of reasons. But as far as the Mexican community goes, which is by far the largest
exactly.
maybe 75-80%. I don't think so. And, you know, we can spin Obama again and again in terms of what he didn't do and what he might have done and, you know, parse out all the things. But in the end, the voter, the Latino voter, is going to look at all the disappointments he or she's had with Obama and the expectations he or she has with Romney, the Arizona law, things like that. I think that Obama's going to hold on to a pretty good-sized share of that
vote. Are we going to see a lot of Jan Brewer and Democratic ads targeting?
Absolutely. And I'm not trying to suggest that Obama's done everything right. But in the end, for some people, I don't happen to think this way, but for some people, you know, politics is the lesser of two evils,
mm-hmm.
you know, a voting decision.
Yeah.
You know, and I think for most of them, they're going to hold their nose. Just like African Americans did for so many years, disappointed again
mm-hmm.
and again.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to hold their nose, they're going to say, whatever my issues are with this guy, you know, doesn't even know who I am. That's sort of what I think.
Yeah.
Carla, we were talking about your cookies and yogurt theory. Could you share that with people?
Well,
now it's time for the cooking segment.
Y'all were talking about Twitter and its effects on the race, and this is really where we're seeing the effects of some crazy social media sort of ripples in the campaign. And I have to say, the media's sort of ADD when it comes to, you know, Hillary Rosen, Ted Nugent. We're all over the place sometimes because this stuff hits on social media. And this week, a perfect example, I saw Chris Matthews just go, ecstatic when Obama was visiting a college campus this week, and a young woman spilled her frozen yogurt all over him, you know, and Matthews was didn't he handle that fabulously? It was incredible. The woman ended up on MSNBC being interviewed for like 10 minutes on MSNBC.
Everyone's
going to
start spilling food on
it. I know. It's crazy. So there was this contrast, and many of the media outlets were contrasting. Obama did so well with the yogurt. And then there was Mitt Romney with the cookies. You know, he sits down, and I don't know if any of you have seen this one where he sits down and somebody brings him some cookies, and he goes, wow, these look like they're from the local 7-Eleven, and it turns out it was like the best bakery in town, and everybody is really, you know, like angry. Does this guy not know how to relate to anybody? It was sort of a moment, and this is one of the factors that's going to play into this race. Likeability. Everybody's using this likeability. Who do you relate to more? Who can you, you know, it's not more than just who will I sit down and have a beer with. It's kind of who is sort of a regular guy that understands what I'm about. And those two moments, although they're so superficial in so many ways, media like us, we pick up on this stuff, and it becomes a very big deal, more so than it should.
Well, if you were to pick two people you would not think would be naturals for identifying with a common person, it might be, you know, a corporate investment person and a college constitutional professor from Chicago.
Right, exactly.
So it's a little bit interesting to see those two pitted together on that.
But the national polls show Obama just trumping Romney on likability by a huge margin. Oh, that's fine. Meanwhile, who's going to pay my bills? So, I mean, likability is a wonderful thing to have. I'd rather have it than not. But, you know, in the end, I'm sorry, it's the economy.
And
you know, it doesn't have to be great. It just has to be going in a good direction. And, you know, if it's going up, getting better, Obama. If it flatlines, you know, we start to see unemployment claims over 400,000 a week, and they're teetering as it is, 388 this last week, for 3 weeks in a row now, watch out. Watch out. This will turn on a dime. And I'll have his hands full.
But I think on the likability thing, what's interesting is that people do want... You know, Republicans were criticizing Obama this week for being on Jimmy Fallon's show.
Yeah, yes.
Which, if you saw it, it was funny. It was really funny. He did a very good job. Even Deborah, we talked about this. You thought he was funny.
I thought it was very funny.
So that means he was funny. And you're going to see him this weekend all over the White House Correspondents Association dinner, which has become a very big deal. I mean... The Rove ad that hit today, which you should all look at on cable, it has this, like, there he is, the celebrity president. He's so cool. And even Donald Trump came out and criticized this ad and said, why are you making this guy into such a cool guy? Everybody wants to vote for somebody who's cool, you know. I mean, so this is, we're dealing with these sort of superficial, you know.
But what's the last line in that ad? The last line out of that ad, and one out of two college graduates doesn't have a job.
It's true. That is true. That is the message, but I think the message gets lost. I think the message gets lost in the ad.
Really?
It's this whole sort of one after the other image of Obama doing very cool stuff. And that's why Trump criticized it, saying you're really turning him into a star. The Republicans tried this attack in the last election, John election.
Yeah,
that's right. Comparing him to Britney Spears.
And it really
Spears.
Worked for him, didn't it?
Right. And we know how that worked.
Yeah,
so,
that's right.
Well, not
a smart one, is it?
Well, we're seeing some other surrogates who are coming out, especially now that it's, you know, take off the gloves time, general election, essentially. Joe Biden slammed Romney for lacking the extensive foreign policy experience that Obama had when he was running for president. And John Boehner is... you know, rounded on to Obama this week. Who are, if you would, maybe handicap, who are the best surrogates for landing punches, if you will, on the other side?
Well, Ann Romney is Mitt Romney's best surrogate. She's just incredibly likable, and the personality which she lacks, she exudes. And so I think, and you're going to be seeing a lot of Ann Romney. Over time.
And I think Michelle Obama also, you know, her likability is, you know, her poll numbers are 75%. She's very positive.
Yeah. That's right. She's,
but on the political side, yeah, you saw Biden out there. And Biden sort of threw out this week what he said is going to be sort of the bumper sticker for the campaign. You know, mm-hmm. Bin Laden's dead, GM is alive. that was his thought. I think
it's much better than Romney using the bumper sticker, dog is my co-pilot. That just would
Yet another Twitter moment that we all, you know, fell for. But you know, on Boehner's, you know, Boehner's being a very tough attack dog. Mm-hmm. It looks better for him to do it than I think that for the Romney campaign to go after Obama with that kind of.
I thought John Boehner was fascinating this week because he really came out and hit Barack Obama for using Air Force One for all these, you know, these are clearly political trips. Now, I get it. He's the president of the United States. He can't take Southwest, right? So this is not my big issue. And yet, I think that people are watching Barack Obama, and you're always seeing him being political. He's always itching for a fight that can't get resolved but makes the other guy look bad. And he's always complaining about partisanship while he's out there campaigning all the time. And I thought it was fascinating that Boehner decided to take the gloves off this week and hit him on it while he's out hitting the campaign trail. I was surprised that Boehner was this tough. That's really not his style. Mm-hmm. And I think that they're finding a weakness. I think that, you know, even though he has to campaign from Air Force One, and I get that, there's such a thing as the law of diminishing returns. And I think the Republicans are going to hit the Obama administration for being too partisan and too re-election-oriented and not really focused on trying to fix the economy and get things done. And it's a problem. I think it can stick.
You know, I think you're right that sort of resonates with average voters, the idea, why is he campaigning so much? But there is sort of it is disingenuous, I think, the whole attack, because we know that every president has done this. And the other sort of underlying thing is the FEC rules have changed since 2009. It is much more expensive. The president has to pay back a lot more money.
We don't know how much, though. They won't tell us.
But now the president's paying, like, charter fares. That Bush was not held to those standards. So there is a difference. But Deborah is right. I think that sort of general theme resonates with people. We see Obama here all the time. Obama, Biden, Michelle Obama. Have we seen a public event of theirs here in California? I think once in the time that he's come to California. So if anybody can sort of relate to that argument,
why don't we invite some of you to join us in the conversation if you want to take a spot behind the microphone and ask us your questions.
Just real quickly while they line up, I have a different take here. I think most of this is way beyond or not even touched by the general public. I mean, you know, this is inside baseball. For us, we're fascinated by right? Mm-hmm. But for most people, you know, am I going to have my Social Security?
Yeah.
Am I going to lose my house? I mean, I think that campaigning, Air Force One, Southwest, I don't know, he's on a plane. You know?
Good afternoon. Thank you for doing this program. It's great.
Thank you.
I plan to come back. It's wonderful. My question, along the Mitt Romney question about the Latino vote, would the selection of the female governor of New Mexico,
Susana Martinez,
or Senator Marco Rubio from Florida help in any way with that vote, or would that look like the pandering you're speaking about?
It's a good question, but there's problems with both. Susana Martinez is a fairly new governor in office, brings him the Palin problem, and she has the other problem, bigger problem. She has said over and over again, no, there's no way I want it. She's got a disabled family member or something she has to take care of. That way, it would be great were things different with her. So that would be a two for a woman. The woman, that's not going to happen. Rubio, I think we all put him in probably the top five or the top three even. The polls show he really doesn't help Romney that much. The Cuban vote is very different, as Larry said, from the Mexican vote, and he doesn't play with that vote. No. So I tend to think he won't be picked for that either.
I think Romney's going to pick the most boring candidate he can possibly.
Someone will make him look exciting.
Yes. He's going to go for the most bland person possible.
Yes. We agree on that. We think maybe Portman might be the
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We haven't even talked about it. Rob Portman in a heartbeat. Because he's got.
Okay, we all agree on that.
Yeah, he's got he's got OMB experience.
Yes.
He's now in the Senate. He's got good contacts. He's well respected. He's a conservative. I guess people would call him an enlightened conservative, like Deborah here. you know. and he will mesh very well. And it's the state Romney needs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's bland.
Yes.
Not exciting.
Next question, please.
Not exciting. Anyway.
Yes, sir.
I don't have a question. I have a couple of comments. One is, I don't think this country can handle four more or eight more years of George Bush mentality. The super white hard right in this country, they had 8 years, they collapsed the country. I think if you do that again, you can kiss this country goodbye. I think we got set back one, maybe two generations with the last time we went with all this funny stuff from the super white hard right. And the second comment I would make is about Mitt Romney. I think this has taken the class and the style that the city of San Francisco emulates to a new low. This is the biggest railroad job. I can't believe that they have railroaded this guy as much as they have. I mean, it's really not complimentary to this community.
It's certainly something being watched nationally. And
yeah, absolutely.
People are thinking about the city as a result of that.
I'd like to go international for a minute. This morning's Washington Post, a conservative columnist, Charles Krauthammer, faults Obama very severely for his inaction on Syria. He quotes Obama's comments about Libya that would have applied to Syria and many other details. And then said that Obama wants to be international about it, but he's going through the United Nations where he knows that Russia and China will oppose rather than through NATO, as Clinton did in Kosovo and Bosnia. I'd appreciate your comments.
That's a good question. Any thoughts?
Well, there are a couple of things here. First of all, Clinton goes into Kosovo and Bosnia with NATO behind him. Okay, so it's not just the U.S. running off like crazy. I think a lot of people are worried that we've just stuck our noses and our men and our billions, or trillions, in places where we get nothing back because we're either going it alone or it's cosmetically we've got other nations, you know, offering a box of Band-Aids and this and that to be partners. Thanks. The Libya example to me is sort of the direction that Obama seems to be taking. In other words, are the partners in the region sufficiently upset? Do they feel a threat to their regimes? Do they believe that this is at a point where they have to marshal their resources collectively to try to get that guy out, then come to European nations and even the United States to help them behind the scenes? That worked in Libya. And I think that's kind of the approach that they're probably going to do in Syria. We can only be in so many places at once before we're nowhere. And I think it's real easy. It's always easy to get involved in something. It's a lot more difficult to get out of it, like Afghanistan.
I have not read the Krauthammer column. I think that there are conservatives who rightly hit Obama for not being tougher on Syria earlier when we were tougher on Libya. Having said that, I don't share the appetite for a military engagement with Syria. And I think a lot of people, we were lucky to get out alive in Libya and have things work as well as they did. There weren't enough, they didn't have the arsenal that we needed to have. The drone strategy of we're going to fight a war from the air, that's positive, it saves American lives. But you can't do that forever, which is one of the reasons why George Bush emphasized boots on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think that that's one of those inside the beltway things that really resonates with a certain population. I think Barack Obama could use that against Mitt Romney if he decides to take that cudgel up personally.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. You've talked about liabilities a lot, and nobody's mentioned the Tea Party. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what you all think about that as a liability, because it seems like an awful lot of people are frustrated with Washington largely because of what's happened with the Tea Party refusing to do anything.
That's working two ways. Yeah, some people are very angry with the Tea Party because they think that they've really sort of kept Boehner, you know, his hands tied. Boehner is a classic, you know, consummate deal maker, and he's been prevented from doing it. Other people are thrilled, and we've got maybe 10 or 12 Senate races this year where the Tea Party and its allies are really involved. And there could Dick Lugar in Indiana may lose his mm-hmm. seat. Orrin Hatch in Utah. And the list goes on. For many of these folks, they've had a taste of their success. And they're not about to go away. And that is their goal. Get control of the Senate this year. I think it's going to be very interesting to see if they do. I know that's not what you wanted to hear. Yeah. But
yeah, there were some thoughts that the Tea Party had its peak in 2010. I think they're still going to play big. We've seen activism here. And as you know, as you just said, a lot of races where these activists are going to be key in possibly flipping.
And I'd compare the Tea Party to Occupy movement, which is the same thing.
Right.
And, I mean, we just saw two Democrats lose re-election early on. Moderate Democrats are disappearing, as moderate Republicans are disappearing. This is not just the Tea Party, folks. It's both parties.
Yeah.
Well, briefly, before we get to our news quiz, can we talk about some of the faces of the primary that are no longer with us? Almost like an Oscars category. if you will, talk a little bit about some, you know, the Michelle Bachmans, the Newts, the Rick Perrys, the Santorums. Which of them do you think, each of you, I hope, which of them do you think we're going to see again, or which of them do you think kind of this was their swan song, this was their attempt? You know, oftentimes losing politicians make it perennial.
Well, are you talking about a president, another presidential? Rick Perry's already talked about another president in 2016. You know, Michelle Bachmann's going to continue to be a voice for conservatives. She got much, much better in that race from beginning to end. Rick Perry, very personable, you know. I mean, he's the only politician. I sat down with him for an interview. You know, he'll sit there and say, well, where's your family from? You know, like really a personable guy. Yeah. That's not going away. He's going to continue, except, you know, his weaknesses were exposed. Gingrich?
His weakness being getting votes.
Gingrich hasn't got out. Nobody even cares. I mean, you barely notice that he's getting out. Rick Santorum, obviously, he's planning on running again.
Yeah. Yes, very clearly, yeah.
So,
yeah. And Ron Paul, I mean, he just turned out 3,000 people in Berkeley 2 weeks ago. I covered him. 6,000 in L.A. His movement, he is creating a movement of young voters. What's going to happen with that, I think, will be very, very interesting to watch.
And, of course, now that I think the even larger question, in a sense, might be for the Democrats. I mean, assuming Obama wins, all right, everyone is, the day he
the
wins,
jockeying begins immediately,
everyone's jockeying for 2016. And who emerges? You know, you got Governor O'Malley in, Maryland. You've got...
Joe Biden?
That's a good question. I don't think so.
Cuomo?
I don't think so.
Cuomo?
But I'll tell you a name that I think is going to emerge that I didn't think 6 months ago. Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. And won't Blagojevich be out of prison by then? I mean, he might...
I didn't hear you.
Rod Blagojevich, won't he be available?
As a running mate.
Yes, yes. You lock up a certain group. Well, thank you to my panelists. Let's quickly do our news quiz now. Just raise your hand if you think you know the answer. I'll call on you and shout it out. First question is, the U.S. Secret Service has become embroiled in another prostitution scandal. What country did this take place in? I'm sorry?
El Salvador.
Yeah, El Salvador, that's right.
El Salvador, that's right, yeah.
Luckily, they're able to use the same language, I guess, that's in Colombia.
They're both romance languages.
Yeah. Oh.
So to speak. Oh.
Yesterday at the Commonwealth Club, Fortune magazine journalist Adam Leshinsky was interviewing Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, and he asked about Taxmageddon. What is Taxmageddon? Yes, sir.
This year.
That's right. It's also called the fiscal cliff, I guess.
And the Social Security tax cuts end at the end of the year, too.
Yeah. So tax apocalypse might be another one.
Tax again, I like better.
Just offering that. Okay, third question. George Zimmerman, the neighborhood watch man in Florida who's accused of killing Trayvon Martin, he's being criticized by his own lawyer for not revealing how much money he had raised for his defense through his website. Question, how much money did he raise? Let me try the gentleman in front of you. Just to, yes, sir. Yeah, $200,000, that's right. He was released on $150,000 bail. So there's questions of whether the judge would have made a different bail amount had he known how much money was sitting there. Question number four, New York City's Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum is getting a space shuttle to add to its collection. Question, which shuttle did it get? It was just flying over New York recently. Sorry? Enterprise, that's right. The prototype shuttle. It actually never flew in space. And I remember as a kid in the 1970s when they did the test flight of the Enterprise. And I was young enough to think that meant we were really going into space. Okay, here's a question you might know. People have been gathered in Madrid, Spain, for Zombie Pride Day in commemoration of what famous film? This is news you just have to have, folks. So anybody know what film? Do you think George Romero, maybe? Close. Night of the Living Dead. That's right.
Of course.
Okay. Well, we have a bonus question, and this one comes with a prize. Larry Grissom's book,
okay.
Not So Golden After All.
Signed copy.
I'm going to sign it for you. So you have to raise your hand this one because I have to make sure we catch the right person. So let's not do Zombie Pride Day. Let's call it. Okay. It's California, so we like to take everything to the ballot. There's a November ballot measure that has been certified that would give voters a chance to repeal what? I saw your hand first. That's right. You're the winner. It's one of the few red state things we do here in California. Right? Bluest of blue states. Well, listen, thank you to our panelists, Dr. Larry Gersten, Deborah J. Saunders, Carla Marinucci. Thank you all of you for coming out today.